people in America fear their government, and the government is being run by too many powerful agencies like the IRS and others. I think it's time the people take the country back through their representative government.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. The complete reading of American Free Press weekly newspaper, number 15, April 11th, 2011. 9/11 survivor won't back down. Army specialist April Gallup says she saw no plane in Pentagon rubble, by Mark Anderson. Perhaps the most compelling direct testimony regarding the harrowing events of September 11, 2001, comes from survivor and former Army specialist April Gallup, who, with her two-month-old child, Elisha, in tow, arrived at the Pentagon just minutes before a powerful explosion rocked the building that Tuesday morning. Ms. Gallup spoke out on her experience at conferences where this AFP writer heard her story, which has never wavered. Ms. Gallup wants justice, so in coordination with the Center for 9/11 Justice, she filed a federal lawsuit and is staying the course, whatever the odds. The defendants are former Vice President Dick Cheney, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and General Richard Myers, U.S. Air Force retired, former Acting Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman. Transportation Secretary and eyewitness Norman Mineta testified to the now disbanded 9/11 Commission that Cheney, on duty during the attacks, urgently spoke of an approaching hostile attack against the Pentagon, but, incredibly, ordered a military stand-down. Since the World Trade Center in Manhattan had already been hit, Ms. Gallup continues to ask why neither air defenses nor alarm warnings were implemented in and around the Pentagon. The moment she turned on her work computer on September 11, 2001, a powerful blast knocked her unconscious. Injured, she soon awoke with debris on her, even while reaching around and pulling her child, also injured, who survived from the debris pile. When Ms. Gallup exited the building through the hole made by the explosion, she saw no sign of plane wreckage. Yet the world is still told 10 years later that American Airlines Flight 77 rammed into history's most sophisticated command center without any attempted interception and vaporized, which various researchers say is absurd. Ms. Gallup also maintains that federal officials repeatedly preached to her that a large commercial airliner hit the Pentagon, and that she was strongly advised not to state otherwise. "I could have very early given up," Ms. Gallup told AFP March 29th. "My efforts are much larger than many people think they are." She now is fighting to obtain subpoena power with the help of attorney William Veal and support through CenterFor911Justice.org. Talking with AFP, she asked, "Do we want certain people in a position where they cannot ever be brought to justice?" Federal District Judge Denny Chin dismissed Ms. Gallup's lawsuit in a lower court, claiming that the complaint was based on cynical delusion and fantasy, but Ms. Gallup won't buckle. Her appeal, as AFP went to press, was slated to go before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit on April 5th in New Haven, Connecticut. She is citing a violation of civil rights, conspiracy, and other wrongs, the complaint states. "This case is premised on an allegation of broad complicity in the attack on the part of key U.S. government officials," says the complaint. Page 2. Personal from the editor. Warning: graphic photos. Some readers may take offense at the shocking pictures printed on page 4 in this week's edition. These photographs are certainly horrifying and are not for the faint of heart. In AFP's editorial office, there was a debate over what kind of message we're sending about our soldiers on the front lines. While it's true many U.S. soldiers represent the best our country has to offer, many others are being drawn from the dregs of society so that the Pentagon can meet its quotas for cannon fodder to send to the front lines. After much deliberation, our final decision was that it's important to publish these photos for a number of reasons. They are being circulated widely in European, Asian, and Middle Eastern newspapers and on the internet, but U.S. newspapers have yet to print them. So most Americans remain woefully ignorant of this horrifying issue that even the president of Afghanistan has addressed to his people. Also, if our position is the United States should not even be in Afghanistan, why would we censor ourselves like the rest of the American news business? Over the years, we have asked our supporters to weigh in on whether we should expend more ink highlighting all the good news out there. Overwhelmingly, our readers have responded that we need to do our job, which is giving Americans the truth, no matter who is bothered by it. In another important story, the Cook nuclear plant near Bridgman, Michigan, used to be part of my beat as a reporter in my earlier journalism days before AFP. I toured the plant, attended NRC hearings and safety drills, and met various protesters. Some of the protesters believed anything nuclear, save for the sun itself, is bad. And I remember another viewpoint on bumper stickers. Before you say no nukes, no nukes. Well, that statement is fair enough. Then there is Yucca Mountain, that remote underground nuclear waste storage facility that has been languishing incomplete in Nevada. Will or should such a central facility ever be used now that Japan's events shocked the world? That subject also is raised inside this AFP. These developments will be monitored by AFP. The general public safety and the need for cheap, reliable energy both matter. Surely a variety of energy sources need to be studied more, with costs and the energy independence of individuals, communities, and the nation kept in mind. Mark Anderson. News you may have missed. Obama sending wrong message. During a recent interview with Univision, the top Spanish language channel in the United States, President Obama responded to a question from a teenaged girl who admitted to being in the United States illegally. Our deportation of non-criminals is down, and that's because we want to focus our resources on those folks who are destructive to the community, said Obama. And for a young person like that young woman who we just spoke to, who's going to school, doing all the right things, we want them to succeed. Qualified abortion law. Arizona Governor Jan Brewer signed into law on March 29th a measure that outlaws abortions based on sex or gender of the baby. According to published reports, only the doctor would be prosecuted if he conducts an abortion where it can be proven that the pregnancy was terminated to help the parents select the gender or race of the child. Largest deficit ever. In February, the federal government posted its largest monthly deficit in history, a $223 billion shortfall, according to recently published reports. 20 years in Libya. The father of peace studies, Johann Galtung, predicted the collapse of the Soviet Union and the refusal of Egyptian soldiers to attack civilians. His prediction of the collapse of the U.S. Empire in 2020 appears to be on schedule, wrote columnist David Swanson. So it was noteworthy when he predicted that the war in Libya would last 20 years. If, however, NATO and the opposition were to kill Gaddafi, the fighting could go on for more than 20 years. Oil spill may be killing dolphins. The first birthing season for dolphins has started since the BP oil gusher in the Gulf of Mexico, and scientists report a spike in the number of stillborn and dead baby dolphins. Something is amiss, Bill Walker, head of the Mississippi Department of Marine Resources, told the Sun Herald. Some of these mothers were probably exposed to oil. Whether it rendered them unable to carry their calves, we just don't know. So who approved Project Gunrunner? President Obama recently responded to questions about Project Gunrunner, a secret federal program that allowed gun buyers to purchase weapons in gun stores in U.S. border states and then take them across the border into Mexico where they were given to drug cartels. AFP's Pat Shannon and Victor Thorne detail this government operation, initiated by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives in AFP's March 7th to 14th and March 28th, 2011 editions. I did not authorize it. Eric Holder, the Attorney General, did not authorize it, Obama said. There may be a situation here in which a serious mistake was made. Nanotech miracle. Researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have created tiny computer chips known as nanoparticles that can be implanted into human beings in order to monitor for cancer, heart disease, and other illnesses. So far, the scientists have only conducted tests on lab mice, but human trials may begin soon. Go forth and multiply. On January 27th, AFP office manager Julia Foster's daughter gave birth to a healthy son, bringing the grand total of Mrs. Foster's grandchildren to a whopping 14, all of whom are boys, except one little girl. Congratulations. Massive corporatism spreads. The Trans-Texas Corridor, TTC, part of the NAFTA superhighway network located in the Lone Star State, keeps returning from the dead, reports Texans Uniting for Reform and Freedom. State Representative Larry Phillips has introduced HB 3789, which resurrects the TTC, without the reviled name attached, a TURF news bulletin reports. The Texas Senate just passed SB 1007 that would sell off our public roads to the highest bidder on Wall Street, i.e. private toll operators. Major discontent. A 250,000 mostly peaceful demonstrators marched through central London on March 26th against the toughest cuts to public spending since World War II, with some small breakaway groups smashing windows at banks and shops and spray-painting logos on the walls, Associated Press noted. And while another group of black-clad protesters hurled paint bombs and ammonia-filled light bulbs at police, only 500 out of the 250,000 acted out of line. Page 3, AFP on the Federal Reserve. Creature author schools America on Fed, but analysts fear Griffin's appearance on Glenn Beck program a sign of something ominous, by Pat Shannon. When Fox News commentator Glenn Beck had author G. Edward Griffin as his TV guest on March 25th, millions of Americans saw and heard a scathing hour-long report that contained not one good and encouraging thing about the Federal Reserve System. But the question is, why expose the crimes now that have been protected for a century? Moreover, why would the system use its decidedly phony conservative shill, Beck, to suddenly expose the fraud in the banking system by interviewing one whose truth-telling has been ignored and avoided by the mainstream media for decades? Is the Fed finally about to become history? The money powers will never surrender voluntarily, and the only apparent motive, from their perspective, for dismantling America's current central bank, the Fed, would be to replace it with a similar system with the same owners, under another name, issuing a new currency for the world. Since the death of Eustace Mullins, premier critic of the Fed, Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, has achieved the unofficial status as the elder statesman of the monetary realists. He and Beck gave a seminar on the deceptive history of the Fed, dating to its secret founding by the financial elite at Jekyll Island, Georgia. Never disagreeing on anything, particularly the century-long sham this act perpetrated on the American people, Griffin and Beck pointed out that following a few failed attempts under various disguises, the Federal Reserve Act was finally passed on December 23, 1913, mainly through the efforts of Virginia Representative Carter Glass, a puppet of the bankers. When asked about the high level of secrecy surrounding the Jekyll Island 1910 meeting, to which such recognizable faces as Senator Nelson Aldrich, a Rockefeller in-law, and banker J.P. Morgan traveled under false names, Griffin explained that the public was prevented from knowing that the so-called solution was being supplied by these same guys who had created the nation's financial problems in the first place. When the first Federal Reserve Bank was established in 1914, the people were assured that there would always be enough gold in the treasury to redeem whatever notes were put into circulation, but it was a lie. There was never more than 40% on hand, and the percentage dwindled from there to what Griffin says is now nothing. The gold has disappeared. He told Beck emphatically, "There's no gold in Fort Knox. If they had it, they would show it." Griffin referred to the Fed as a Ponzi scheme that can work only as long as they keep expanding the money supply, adding, "Lying is all they know how to do." Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke says, "We're not printing money, we're digitizing it," Griffin added, with a what's-the-difference look on his face. According to Griffin, the 2% to 3% published inflation rate is another lie, and the real rate is more like 20% because, he reasoned, gold has always been the yardstick, and that 20% is its rate of increase in paper dollar cost. In late March, the privately owned and controlled Federal Reserve was forced to disgorge tens of thousands of pages of documents detailing secret loans that were made to financial institutions. The disclosure came as a result of a Supreme Court ruling in a case brought by two reporters for the New York-based Bloomberg News. Early reports indicate that foreign banks were some of the biggest beneficiaries of the U.S. central bank's easy money policy, showing that the Fed was not only busy bailing out American bankers, but also foreign bankers, such as the Royal Bank of Scotland, Germany's Commerce Bank, and France's Société Générale. As AFP continues to pore over the document dump, look for a detailed story in the April 18th edition. Suggested reading. For more on the manipulation of America's money throughout U.S. history, we recommend Out of Debt, Out of Danger by Representative Jerry Voorhees, Democrat, California. Soft cover, 234 pages, $20 plus $3 shipping and handling. From AFP, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, number 100, Washington, D.C., 20003. Call toll-free 888-699-6397 to charge. Page 4, AFP on the War Against Afghanistan. Gruesome photos reveal sadism run rampant, by Keith Johnson. Coalition forces in Afghanistan fear that gruesome pictures showing American troops posing with the corpses of murdered and mutilated Afghan civilians may provoke a more devastating backlash than graphic photographs taken of U.S. troops abusing prisoners in the notorious Iraqi prison Abu Ghraib. In one of three photographs recently published in an edition of Germany's Der Spiegel magazine, Army Corporal Jeremy Morlock is pictured smiling as he poses near the body of a dead young victim whose head is yanked back as if he were a hunting trophy. Der Spiegel claims to have nearly 4,000 similar photographs and videos. The vast majority of the photos remain under lock and key, but some have leaked out on the internet. These items are said to be part of a collection that members of a self-described American kill team compiled while deployed in northern Afghanistan's Kandahar province early last year. 12 soldiers are currently standing trial in the U.S. on various charges connected to the slaying of unarmed Afghans that occurred in that region between January and May 2010. 5 of the soldiers are accused of premeditated murder. They allegedly engaged in sport killings and then attempted to cover up their crimes by staging combat situations to appear as though they had been provoked. The other 7 have been accused of collecting the body parts of dismembered victims, abusing drugs, and attacking a fellow soldier who blew the whistle. Morlock has already reached a plea agreement with prosecutors and could serve a maximum prison term of 24 years in exchange for cooperation in testifying against his co-defendants. In typical fashion, the U.S. government has distanced itself from the atrocities and laid the blame solely at the feet of the young men it trained to kill. Photographs depict actions repugnant to us as human beings and contrary to the standards and values of the United States Army, said Army Colonel Thomas Collins in an official statement from the Pentagon. We apologize for the distress these photos cause. The statement is hauntingly reminiscent of many others issued by the United States in the wake of similar tragedies. Following the Abu Ghraib scandal, then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld offered an almost identical apology when he appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee on May 7, 2004, saying, "To those Iraqis who were mistreated by members of the U.S. Armed Forces, I offer my deepest apology. It was inconsistent with the values of our nation. It was inconsistent with the teachings of the military to the men and women of the armed forces, and it was certainly fundamentally un-American." Contrary to the claims made in these statements, such brutality seemed quite consistent with the manner in which some American troops conduct themselves in the foreign countries where they've been deployed. Aside from these latest incidents in Afghanistan and the well-known atrocities carried out at Abu Ghraib, where prisoners were physically, psychologically, and sexually tortured by American captors, several other callous acts have been documented in recent years, suggesting that a sadistic culture of violence is epidemic within the ranks of our armed services personnel. In 2007, U.S. soldiers aboard an Apache helicopter repeatedly opened fire on a group of unarmed civilians in Baghdad, leaving 2 men dead and several others severely injured, including 2 children. Leaked footage of the killings contained audio where the soldiers can be heard celebrating the deaths and laughing as a Bradley fighting vehicle runs over one of the dead Iraqis. Then, in 2008, a Marine on patrol in Iraq was videotaped throwing a puppy over a cliff while being cheered on by a fellow Marine. That Marine, Lance Corporal David Motari, has since been kicked out of the military. What is particularly disturbing about these acts is that they are not just carried out by one disturbed individual, but by groups of them who all seem to share the same sadism. This contradicts U.S. claims that these are isolated incidents carried out by rogue elements. The only reason they appear isolated is because they have been made notorious by the video, audio, and photographic evidence that happens to have exposed them. Meanwhile, thousands more civilian deaths go unexplained. In Afghanistan, in excess of 2,700 civilians were killed in 2010. Many of these casualties can be blamed on the ruthless policies carried out under the direction of our top military brass. One of the most vicious and despised tactics currently employed by the U.S. consists of night raids, military operations by U.S. troops who break into civilian homes in the dead of night to look for weapons and suspects. It is an affront to local cultures and more unpopular than airstrikes. With this callous disregard for human rights, is it any wonder our soldiers mimic the same attitude? Though the U.S. continues to fearmonger about the possible repercussions that these kill team photographs may spark, it's not likely to manifest itself inside Afghanistan. Those people don't need photographs to remind them of the daily horrors that American occupation brings. They see these things with their own eyes, and the incredible image they imprint on their minds leaves a far more lasting impression than any film. Page 6, AFP on the Global Elite. Top D.C. paper pressured on Bilderberg blackout, by James P. Tucker, Jr. Long ago, I called Jimmy Lee Hoagland, associate editor of the Washington Post, and inquired about the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission, TC. Because he had attended these meetings for many years, I explained, I wanted him to tell me when and where for both. His response on December 16, 2010, unfortunately, I can't help. I am not in the Trilateral or Bilderberg loops these days. I believe Jimmy Lee was lying. Even if sudden guilt feelings gripped him, he has attended these meetings for many years. He escorts the Post publisher who has attended each meeting since 1954. So Hoagland certainly would know the whens and wheres. Both groups always, at their farewell Monday morning breakfast, celebrate when and where they will meet next, and they always get the anticipated reminder letter in January or February so they can pencil in their next meeting dates. Now, the new ombudsman of the Post, Patrick B. Pexton, seems to be innocent. He assumed the role only in March of this year and came from smaller newspapers. So I called and emailed him, 202-334-7582, his email, ombudsman@washingtonpost.com, this entire article on March 25th. You are off to a good start, I wrote to Pexton. Your column denouncing the plagiarism of Post columnist Sari Horowitz, a three-time Pulitzer winner, is commendable. But your biggest expose is an easy walk from your desk. Just walk into the offices of Jimmy Lee Hoagland, associate editor, and Donald Graham, chairman of the board. Ask them about the annual closed meetings of Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission they always attend. These are groups of international financiers and political leaders from Europe and North America. They have an interlocking leadership, Rockefellers, Rothschilds, and a common agenda. High officials, including heads of state, attend from Europe. A high official of the White House and the Secretaries of State, Treasury, Defense, and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, among other luminaries, always attend. I continued in my letter. Bilderberg has tried, since its inception in 1954, to maintain absolute secrecy, to keep its very existence secret. Bilderberg wants nobody to know that it will meet June 9 to 12 in St. Moritz, Switzerland. About 120 will attend Bilderberg. Armed guards will seal off their hotel, and nobody unconnected to Bilderberg will be allowed in. The Trilateral Commission, with about 300 participants, will be less obtrusive when it meets in Washington, D.C., April 8 to 10. TC will seal off two floors with security, keeping all others out. Both groups work together to get the United States into a war with Libya and to promote global taxes and oil price increases, among other things. Now, when you visit, Hoagland and Graham will be shocked that you know about these groups and will sputter that they are all good people doing wonderful things and should not be publicized. Ask the same questions I have asked apologists for 30 years. If 120 film stars or 120 professional football players were meeting behind closed doors and armed guards for 3 days, you would bust your butt trying to learn and report on what transpired. Why, then, no curiosity when 120 or 300 of the world's most powerful men meet secretly? I concluded. Also explained that these meetings are criminal because the Logan Act prohibits public officials from holding closed meetings with private citizens to plot public policy. When they mutter that the Logan Act passed in 1799, there are two answers. Unless repealed, it remains the law of the land. And it has been updated and expanded several times, including in the 20th century. Have fun. Then I simply signed it, Jim Tucker, American Free Press. Adventures of a Newshound with Jim Tucker. Tense Visit to the Headquarters of Libya War Planners, by James P. Tucker, Jr. The Trilateral Commission, TC, is still upset that a disturbing number of nationalists are aware that if the rebellion in Libya succeeds, it will greatly strengthen Al-Qaeda, the same nebulous Mideast clique accused of killing 3,000 Americans on September 11, 2001. They fear these patriots may learn of their meeting in Washington, D.C., April 8 to 10. TC and its senior partner, the Bilderberg Group, manipulated the United States into invading Libya to further destabilize the Middle East, as this writer accurately predicted in AFP's March 21st edition. The United States has no legitimate interest in attacking Libya or in occupying much of the Middle East with U.S. troops. But both the TC and Bilderberg want to drive up the price of oil until Americans pay at least $5 a gallon for gas. Huge profits are at stake. Both groups want to appear opposed to war while actually promoting it. For example, Henry Kissinger, an aging but steady power player in both outfits, sadly regretted the current hostilities during a March 23rd national broadcast while saying the United States must continue to fight for humanitarian reasons. This was the general position of all the administration's reluctant warriors. Weeks ago, this journalist trotted up to the Washington, D.C. offices of the Trilateral Commission at 1156 15th Street Northwest, unpublished phone now published here, 202-467-5410. It was one of those offices where you have to push a button before you can open the door. The door opened but had a chain. I placed my foot inside and 2 feet clamped down on mine. Two unsightly ladies peeked through the narrow opening and began screeching. Their words, if that is the correct term, were indecipherable. Let's just say I felt less than welcome. Covering for criminals must be stressful and unpleasant. Page 8, AFP Spotlight on Congress. GOP's fiscal conservatives want welfare expenditures cut back. House Republicans have set for themselves an ambitious agenda as far as reining in the spending free-for-all plaguing Washington for the past 3 decades. This involves radical changes to the country's welfare system, bringing it back to 2007 levels. Representative Jim Jordan, Republican Ohio, the chairman of the Conservative Republican Study Committee and the sponsor of the measure, contends that this is necessary to ensure the fiscal solvency of the United States. Welfare spending has increased by 40% since the collapse of the U.S. economy in the summer of 2007. Some 77 government programs cost U.S. taxpayers an estimated $700 billion in 2010. Conservatives would like to see welfare scaled back to 07 levels, which amounted to about $400 billion. That would take $300 billion out of the U.S. budget if legislators can pull it off. Welfare today is a boondoggle. In many cases, administrative costs are high for federal social services programs. For example, 17 cents out of every dollar spent on food stamps goes to the bureaucrats who run the program, and 23 cents out of every dollar spent on the Housing and Urban Development's public housing program is eaten up in administrative costs. Also, there is the growing problem of illegal immigrants who collect billions of dollars in welfare, though they are in the country in violation of U.S. law. However, the other side of the coin is the growing number of jobless Americans who have been displaced by Wall Street greed and decades of destructive free trade policies. Federal programs like unemployment assistance, temporary assistance for needy families, and food stamps go a long way in helping these once productive but now poor Americans feed their families and pay for shelter. And with the rising price of food, directly attributable to investor speculation in the commodity exchange, more and more Americans are seeking out help from programs like food stamps. From October 2007 to December 2010, the number of people on food stamps has increased by 62% to 44.1 million. That amounts to about 13% of the entire U.S. population. Still, conservative groups are praising Republicans for scrutinizing every federal program. Jordan's proposal is a great step in the right direction to rein in so-called mandatory spending and reduce the $1.6 trillion budget deficit, said Bill Wilson, the president of Americans for Limited Government. Rolling back key portions of federal welfare spending to 2007 levels could save $1.4 trillion over 10 years once fully implemented. Getting government out of the business of mortgage lending. House Republicans plan to introduce 8 separate bills with the goal of putting quasi-government mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac out of business. Representative Jeb Hensarling, Republican Texas, had already introduced legislation that would have gotten the federal government and, by default, American taxpayers out of the mortgage business in 2 years. So far, that bill has been held up in committee. But now, House Republicans believe they will be able to do it more easily by breaking up key aspects of the plan into bite-sized pieces. Fannie and Freddie own about $5 trillion worth of mortgages, which puts taxpayers on the hook if the loans go sour. When the U.S. economy tanked, Fannie and Freddie went under, forcing taxpayers to dump $150 billion into them to keep them afloat. However, Democrats have not embraced attempts to rid taxpayers of the two mortgage giants, despite the fact that many believe banks made huge profits at the height of the housing market by selling home loans to unqualified applicants and then dumping them on the taxpayer-backed Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie expose the taxpayer to unlimited risk and will likely end up receiving the mother of all bailouts, said Hensarling. That is why I introduced the government-sponsored Enterprise Bailout Elimination and Taxpayer Protection Act to end the taxpayer bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, ending tax breaks for charitable giving. For the past 3 years, Congress has been debating whether it should pull the plug on tax deductions for charitable giving. It's a hot topic given the fact that the nonprofit sector is a multi-billion dollar industry with some of the top 501c3s pulling in billions of dollars a year in revenue and executives paying themselves bloated salaries and expenses. Surprisingly, the push to eliminate these tax write-offs is coming from the liberal Obama administration, more specifically Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, who proposed the cuts during discussions on the 2012 budget. It's part of a larger White House plan to reduce the total amount wealthy people can save on their taxes through itemized deductions. Geithner recently testified before the Senate Finance Committee saying, "The only reason we're doing this is we have unsustainable deficits. We've got to bring them down over time, and that's going to force us to do things we'd otherwise not like to do." So far, legislators have been tight-lipped about whether or not they support cutting deductions for charitable giving. Polls have shown that most rich Americans say they would scale back donations to nonprofits if they cannot deduct them on their taxes, so there is no doubt ending tax deductions would hit many charities in their bank accounts. The IRS defines about 20 different tax-exempt kinds of organizations, but only a few groups, such as 501c3s, can take advantage of IRS rules that allow donors to deduct contributions on their taxes. Ironically, some of these not-for-profit groups are also the largest in the world. For example, the international evangelical organization World Vision, a 501c3, brings in nearly $3 billion every year in contributions, and its president, Richard E. Stearns, is paid about $400,000 a year. The powerful Nature Conservancy, also a 501c3, brings in about $1 billion annually. Its CEO, Stephanie K. Meeks, makes $366,000 a year. Page 9, AFP on Culture. Cultural Racial Homogeneity Fortifies a Nation, by Ralph Forbes. Haiti and its capital, Port-au-Prince, were devastated by a magnitude 7.0 earthquake on January 12, 2010. 1 week later, donations totaled $275 million, and in 3 months, the amount hit $15 billion, or $10,000 for each of the 1.5 million homeless Haitians. Yet the average Haitian earns roughly $4 a day. Haiti is even worse off now than it was a year ago. Japan was devastated by a 9.0 magnitude earthquake, the fifth largest on record. It was 1,000 times more powerful than the one that struck Haiti. It triggered a tsunami, a tidal wave 33 feet high that crashed into the city of Sendai in Miyagi Prefecture at 500 miles per hour and roared over the surrounding coastlands, flooding in some cases 10 miles inland. More than 1.5 million Japanese are homeless, with little or no water, food, electricity, heat, blankets, or communications. Roads and bridges are gone, bullet trains, ships, and boats have been lost, and there have been fires, mudslides, storms, blizzards, and a nuclear disaster. It would be a total nightmare except for the saving grace that in Japan there is no widespread looting, price gouging, or other crimes, as far as can be determined. Meanwhile, disaster workers are laboring night and day under hard conditions, sacrificing their lives and health to try to save others. The United States has had to endure Hurricane Katrina in 2005 and the atrocious FEMA rescue response, the 2010 British Petroleum oil catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico, and several massive forest fires that torched thousands of homes. There's also been another oil spill that has polluted 30 miles of Louisiana's shores, or at least 150 square miles, attributed to the Anglo-Suisse Offshore Partners Program. All of this has wreaked havoc on America's infrastructure and the economy while fostering crime. A key point to note here is that Japan is populated by a homogeneous people, united by tradition, with a high sense of honor, ethics, morals, and culture. The United States, to a large extent, was in the same status until the protections afforded by the Immigration and Nationality Act, INA, of 1952, also known as the McCarran-Walter Act, were overthrown. The McCarran-Walter Act was passed in June 1952 under the stewardship of Senators Pat McCarran, Democrat, Nevada, and Francis Walter, Democrat, Pennsylvania. The bill imposed new restrictions on entry quotas to the United States, as well as toughening up the laws regarding dangerous illegal aliens hiding out in the United States. America's founders recognized the consanguinity, relationship by blood or by a common ancestor, a close affinity or connection, of the 13 colonies as a blessing of providence. Shut your hearts against the poison which it conveys, the kindred blood which flows in the veins of American citizens, the common blood which they have shed in defense of their sacred rights, consecrate their union, and excite horror at the idea of their becoming aliens, rivals, enemies. James Madison, father of the Constitution and Bill of Rights, wrote in the Federalist Papers No. 14. Our Constitution requires our legislators to be of one nation. Their connections of blood, of friendship, and of acquaintance embrace a great proportion of the most influential part of the society. The nature of their public trust implies a personal influence among the people, and that they are more immediately the confidential guardians of the rights and liberties of the people. Federalist No. 49. The Declaration of Independence notes that England's King George III has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. But it was the international bankers of the time, through the British and French empires, who used trickery and bribery, guns and rum, for the scalps of white men, women, and children, and inflamed the Indians to wage cruel and savage wars against the Americans and against rival tribes. Big lie of diversity. The masters of the American media peddle the big lie of diversity, telling us that this is what America needs. Liberals believe this, the exact opposite of the truth. What we need is racial and cultural homogeneity, and that is the truth. Page 10, AFP on Global Natural Resources. CAPI, A Pipeline to Profits, by Peter Papaheraklis. The U.S. military is accustomed to promoting and protecting corporate banking interests around the globe, and since wars are the biggest moneymakers, President Dwight D. Eisenhower's warning over 50 years ago echoes down through the ages. Beware of the military-industrial complex. Let's see how his warning plays out today. On December 11, 2010, the presidents of Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, and India's energy minister, signed a document to build a 1,050-mile natural gas pipeline from Turkmenistan to India, referred to as TAPI, an acronym for the four countries through which it will pass. This ambitious project, in the works for 15 years, could be the planet's most geopolitically significant undertaking. Scheduled to start construction in 2012 and continue until 2014, it will carry approximately 33 billion cubic yards of gas from Turkmenistan's huge Develtabad gas field near the Caspian Sea through the war-torn areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. India and Pakistan will each get about 14 billion cubic yards per year, and Afghanistan the remaining five. America has been the main force behind this endeavor since 1992, when General Alexander Haig, a former Secretary of State and NATO Supreme Allied Commander, visited Turkmenistan after the Soviet Union's demise. Quick to realize this area's geopolitical importance, Haig befriended then Prime Minister Saparmurat Niyagov and quickly became an official advisor and confidant. Henry Kissinger, another notorious ex-Secretary of State, soon joined the team. Their policy, which continues to this day, was to tap the mother lodes while giving as little leverage as possible to Russia in the north and Iran to the south. Throughout the Clinton administration, the U.S. jockeyed for position to control the vast energy resources around the Caspian Sea. War in Bosnia and the breakup of Yugoslavia were largely for the same reason, securing passage from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. It's not coincidental that the U.S. built its largest base in a relatively insignificant country like Kosovo, which your tax dollars helped create under the guise of defending persecuted civilians. Turkmenistan President Niyazov was swayed to give an American company, Unocal, the rights to exploit the country's natural gas and build a pipeline to the Arabian Sea. At that time, Kissinger was a Unocal consultant. Pakistan's leader, Benazir Bhutto, later assassinated, was at the time being wooed by Unocal, as were Afghanistan's Taliban leaders, some of whom were brought to the United States for a week in 1997. But the plan never materialized. One reason was that the Taliban wanted more than UNICAL would give. On August 2, 2001, during negotiations between UNICAL and the Taliban, the State Department laid it on the line. According to Charles Broussard in his book Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth, at one moment during the negotiations, U.S. representatives told the Taliban, "Either accept our offer of a carpet of gold or we bury you under a carpet of bombs." Enter 9/11. Osama bin Laden, a one-time CIA asset who had nothing to do with the September 11th attacks, served as a fall guy. By allegedly hiding out in Afghanistan, he provided the U.S. with a convenient excuse to attack that country and get rid of the Taliban. UNICAL executive Hamid Karzai was then made Afghanistan's president, and the Taliban were hunted down in Kandahar and then Pakistan. Notably, it appears a lot of Taliban and Al-Qaeda activity has been along the planned Tappy Path. The U.S. and NATO will be tasked with training 7,000 Afghan troops to provide security in these Taliban strongholds. Some feel the job is impossible since 130,000 U.S. and NATO troops have thus far been unable to accomplish this very task, another excuse for U.S. troops to remain in Afghanistan indefinitely. The TAPI project is expected to cost nearly $10 billion, which will reportedly be funded by the Asian Development Bank. It's unclear at this point, however, what company will be awarded the contract to build the TAPI, or if that decision has been made. It's also difficult to assess U.S. interests. The pipeline doesn't extend to the Arabian Sea, as was UNICAL's original plan, so the U.S. won't be using any of this for its own profit. If a U.S. company is awarded the contract to build TAPI, $10 billion is a paltry sum considering the $390 billion taxpayers have already spent in the past 10 years for U.S. troops to occupy the region. But as usual, the only ones who have definitely profited from the U.S. being in Afghanistan are contractors and bankers. On the other hand, depriving Russia and Iran of this deal is surely a motive, especially Iran, which had its own version of a pipeline in the works, namely the Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline. Using TAPI as an excuse to keep a military presence in the area is also of strategic importance since Turkmenistan is now involved. In essence, Iran is completely surrounded. By not allowing India and Pakistan to develop an economic dependence on Iran through energy needs, the two countries will be less likely to protest a Western military strike or sanctions against Iran in the future. Page 11, AFP on the grab for natural resources. Obama urges Brazil to expand offshore drilling, by Keith Hansen. Just when you thought the schizophrenic relationship between America and big oil couldn't get any weirder, it has. Not quite a year since the Deepwater Horizon oil spill led Barack Obama to implement, by executive order, a deepwater drilling moratorium in the Gulf of Mexico. The very same president recently slipped into Brazil and encouraged that nation to drill deep off its shores. Brazil holds recently discovered oil reserves that could be far larger than ours, Obama said. And as we seek to increase secure energy supplies, we look forward to developing a strategic energy partnership. Obama added, "We want to help you with the technology and support to develop these oil reserves safely. And when you're ready to start selling, we want to be one of your best customers." Jack Girard, president and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute, responded to Obama saying, "It is beyond comprehension the administration would encourage trade for Brazilian oil while obstructing U.S. oil and natural gas development, eliminating related jobs here at home, and decreasing oil and natural gas revenues to the U.S. Treasury when the government is trillions of dollars in debt." The Republican Party weighed in as well, sending out pit bull Sarah Palin to bark. Evidence of the president's anti-drilling mentality and his culpability in high gas prices hurting Americans is there for all to see, she said. Last month, the Republican Governors Association sent a letter to the president criticizing him and the Environmental Protection Agency as pursuing an unreasonably aggressive regulatory agenda that would potentially stifle our fragile economic recovery and seriously impact energy supply, reliability, and affordability for the residents, small businesses, and manufacturers in our states and across the country. Throughout the last four decades, no issue has been as quick to inflame political partisanship as oil, nor as effective at inducing both short- and long-term memory loss. Just before Memorial Day 2007, gas prices shot up to a then-all-time high of $3.28 a gallon, before declining somewhat. The prices rose again in early 2008, hitting $3.28 in March and moving higher, with some sections of the country reaching and breaking through the dreaded $4 per gallon mark. In mid-June 2008, the highest recorded average price topped out at $4.62. During that 2007-2008 gas hike, a Republican was the sitting president, and of course the Democrats came out and hassled him. Both the George W. Bush administration and Congress were criticized for ducking the problem. Bush asked OPEC to boost crude oil production in the hopes of easing energy prices, but his request fell on deaf ears. The topic of domestic drilling was never raised. Well, here we go again. Only this time, folks aren't sweating upper $3 per gallon prices, but potentially $5 and beyond. What should be noted, though, is that since the first oil crisis, U.S. consumers have received messages both mixed and confusing. Oil is a finite resource. Oil is replenishable. We should get off oil. Alternative sources will never work. We should drill at home. We should use other nations' oil. What do we do? At present, when it would again make sense to develop domestic reserves and tap more from Canada, which is more than willing to become an even bigger exporter, the U.S. government is helping fund Brazil's deposits and wants to be the first in line to buy its product. But it's more than curious that, regardless of which party rules Washington, the U.S. somehow remains dependent on foreign oil. This dependency inevitably winds up as one of the justifications for military expansionism. How badly are U.S. oil companies really hurt by domestic moratoriums, considering how many of them are tied into multinational big oil? Perhaps it should be asked, are Obama's paradoxical decisions really his decisions? Another serious Gulf oil spill cover-up may be underway, by Frank Whalen. With the BP oil disaster's tragic anniversary about to arrive, yet another Gulf oil spill has been spotted, highlighting the same corruption and disinformation that was omnipresent in the media 1 year ago. The finger-pointing and ludicrous explanations only emphasize how little truth is available from government and mainstream media sources about the impact of the initial catastrophe and its connection to the newest one. According to The Examiner, on March 18th, a helicopter pilot spotted the latest slick, reportedly 100 miles long and 30 miles off the Louisiana coast. Since then, fishermen reported oil reaching the already ravaged coastline of South Pass, Louisiana. A skeptical U.S. Coast Guard issued several statements dismissing these accounts. The Times-Picayune quoted Coast Guard Operation Controller Paul Bernard as saying, "It would be very unlikely for an individual to observe a 100-mile-long sheen." On March 20th, a Coast Guard vessel took samples to determine what is actually in the water, claiming the next day that the apparent oil slick was actually the result of large amounts of sediment. On March 24th, the Wall Street Journal's Ryan Dezember reported that the Coast Guard changed its story, tracing oil that had washed ashore to a Houston-based drilling operation. This company, Anglo Suisse, disputed the Coast Guard's assessment, saying there were only a few gallons spilled and that they questioned these findings, given that the well in question is non-producing and has been monitored closely for the last 6 months. It's not unusual for an oil company to be cagey on accountability. MarketWatch reports that while BP was claiming only 1,000 barrels a day were leaking during last year's fiasco, congressional investigators found documents indicating BP knew as much as 14,000 barrels could be spilling each day. Government scientists eventually determined the actual spill at 62,000 barrels a day. BP is being investigated for insider trading to find out if their disinformation allowed them to illegally profit. On September 12th, ABC News weighed in, claiming that oil from the BP disaster did not simply vanish, but is sitting on the floor of the Gulf in vast quantities. According to Professor Samantha Joy of the Department of Marine Sciences at the University of Georgia, the oil has not disappeared, but is on the seafloor in a layer of scum. Joy added, "If we're seeing 2.5 inches of oil 16 miles away, God knows what we'll see close in." A source affiliated with the Gulf Oil Spill Remediation Conference postulated that recent seismic activity could have opened faults in the most fractured seafloor in the world, or there may possibly have been another real oil spill being covered up. Page 12, Behind the Scenes. New book says Zionists ready to start World War III, by Michael Collins Piper. A disturbing new book, How the End Begins, The Road to a Nuclear World War III, makes it clear that a third world war involving the likely use of nuclear weapons may be instigated by Israel. Although the author, Jewish-American writer Ron Rosenbaum, believes there are a number of possible flashpoints for nuclear war, He places Israel among the foremost sources for such a conflagration. He foresees a preemptive strike by Israel using either nuclear or conventional weapons against some other nation, probably Iran, in order to prevent that nation from acquiring nuclear arms. This could set off a chain reaction resulting in the further use of nuclear weapons in the ensuing crisis, potentially involving the United States, Russia, Pakistan, India, the list goes on. In fact, Rosenbaum notes that in 2007, when Israel launched a military strike on a presumed Syrian nuclear installation, the London-based Spectator published a little-noticed article on October 6th, quoting a senior British official, "If people had known how close we came to World War III that day, there'd have been mass panic, and we really would have been dealing with the bloody Book of Revelation and Armageddon." Rosenbaum writes, "The fact that the hand of man finds itself recurrently, obsessively scripting fiery, self-immolating, cataclysmic conclusions to the human saga may well be, at the very least, self-fulfilling prophecy. It may also say that deep down we really are a species obsessed with its own self-destruction." This idea of self-destruction being deeply rooted is particularly chilling since Israel's nuclear policy, from the beginning, has been based on the Samson option, immortalized by Jewish-American Pulitzer Prize winner and critic of Israel Seymour Hersh in his book by that title. Like Samson of the Bible, who brought the temple down upon himself and his enemies, the Samson option is the concept that Israel would commit nuclear suicide and bring the rest of the world down with it if Israel's leaders believed Israel was about to be conquered. This theme goes back to the much-heralded ancient Jewish legend of Masada, the purported last stand of Jewish warriors who committed suicide in the face of a Roman onslaught. Although Israeli scholars have proven the Masada story to be largely a myth, the importance of the legend to modern Israel is such that newly anointed Israeli military officers are sworn into their posts proclaiming, "Masada shall never fall again." According to Rosenbaum, the modern Israeli mindset is deeply rooted in the fear of a second Holocaust. This concept, writes Rosenbaum, is a phrase that has become a potential motive, if not a trigger, for the outbreak of World War III in the Middle East. Rosenbaum says, "Israelis tell me that the use of the phrase Second Holocaust has become normalized there." Rosenbaum suggests the Israelis believe the International Conference on the Holocaust held in Tehran in 2006 by the Iranian government, which this writer attended, was an incitement to genocide, a deliberate call in effect for a Second Holocaust, and therefore provide some rationale for Israel to launch a preemptive strike against Iran to prevent a second Holocaust. No such topic was discussed at the conference. As for the morality of such an action, Rosenbaum cites Moshe Halbertal, a professor of ethics and the international law of war at both New York University Law School and the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, describing Halbertal as one of the most widely respected thinkers on the moral and ethical dilemmas of modern warfare, who has authored a code of ethics for the Israeli Defense Forces. Halbertal says that in some cases, a preemptive nuclear strike can be moral, although, in Rosenbaum's assessment of his views, retaliation after being struck by nuclear weapons cannot be. Yet while Halbertal believes Israel could have the right to launch a preemptive strike against Iran, Halbertal, according to the author, seems to be saying, "It's going to happen whether I like it or not." Rosenbaum concludes, "It's almost a fatalistic admission that it will. All this will make it more likely that, sooner or later, Israel will unleash nuclear weapons and risk inaugurating World War III to prevent what they perceive as an impending nuclear strike. Israel will not wait for the world to step in. They may not even wait to be sure their intelligence is rock-solid certain. They can't afford to take that chance. It's not something I advocate. It is something I foresee." Rosenbaum, who calls himself a secular, liberal, non-observant, non-Zionist, American-born Jew with no immediate family members murdered in the Holocaust, rightly fears nuclear war, whether instigated by Israel or otherwise. He closes his book with this plea. "If you're in a position to launch, whoever you are, now or in the future, if you're in a position to send the targeting codes, if it's up to you, whoever you are, my plea is, nothing justifies following orders for genocide. Don't send those codes. Don't twist those keys." For proof that Jews in any number were not gassed by Adolf Hitler, send $10 for a 100-page special issue of the Barnes Review magazine dedicated to the subject. Assembled by AFP's Michael Collins Piper, this all-Holocaust issue has all the information you need to convince yourself that the Holocaust is the biggest hoax of the 20th century. Send request with payment to TBR, P.O. Box 15877, Washington, D.C. 20003. Open threats of nuclear apocalypse by Israel. Demonstrating the Mindset of Those Who Endorse Israel's Use of Nuclear Weapons, author Ron Rosenbaum cites well-known American Jewish academic Dr. David Perlmutter, who wrote a shocking piece in the Los Angeles Times on April 7, 2002. In his essay, Dark Thoughts and Quiet Desperation, Perlmutter issued a threat in no uncertain terms. What is Israel to do? I have other dreams as well, apocalyptic ones. I think Israel has been building nuclear weapons for 30 years. The Jews understand what passive and powerless acceptance of doom has meant for them in the past, and they have insured against it. Masada was not an example to follow. It hurt the Romans not a whit, but Samson in Gaza? With an H-bomb? What would serve the Jew-hating world better in repayment for thousands of years of massacres but a nuclear winter? Or invite all those tut-tutting European statesmen and peace activists to join us in the ovens? For the first time in history, a people facing extermination, while the world either cackles or looks away, have the power to destroy the world, the ultimate justice? Perlmutter is not the only distinguished Jewish voice making such threats. Dr. Martin Van Krevald of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Israel's preeminent geopolitical and military thinker, made his own threat against the non-Jewish world in the January 2003 edition of the Dutch magazine Elsevier. We Israelis possess several hundred atomic warheads and rockets and can launch them at targets in all directions, perhaps even at Rome. Most European capitals are targets of our air force. Our armed forces are not the 30th strongest in the world, but rather the second or third. We have the capacity to take the world down with us, and I can assure you that this will happen before Israel goes under. Page 14, AFP on Nuclear Power. Nuclear Waste Disposal Dilemma by Mark Anderson. The Japanese pursued few, if any, proactive measures over the years on how to dispose of the radioactive fuel rods from their nation's nuclear power plants. The U.S. continues to store spent nuclear fuel rods mainly in large storage facilities at nuclear plant sites across the nation. But the U.S. has been waiting years for the completion of the controversial Yucca Mountain Underground Federal Storage Facility in Nevada for spent nuclear waste. Yucca Mountain is a large, partially built facility not far from the California border. Various federal legislators have tried to complete it, while others have railed against it. A key question is whether the Japanese tragedy will breathe new life into completing Yucca Mountain. There are unavoidable risks associated with transporting different types of nuclear waste to Yucca Mountain via truck and rail. Accidents and derailment, sabotage, etc. But the fact remains that there is still no central, secure U.S. repository for such waste. Although the Japanese tsunami, set in motion by a historically severe earthquake, was perhaps a unique set of circumstances in causing or intensifying Japan's nuclear crisis, it cannot totally be ruled out that the crisis caused by exposed fuel rods at Japan's Fukushima facility could be replayed in the U.S., precisely because spent nuclear fuel is stored in countless locations throughout the U.S., and security measures are never foolproof. How much natural or man-made disasters, including sabotage, could play a role in a U.S. nuclear crisis depends a great deal on the physical location, operating procedures, and overall security, including cybersecurity, of the 104 non-military nuclear power reactors operating at 65 U.S. plants. There are dozens of other reactors, weapons labs, and other facilities associated with national defense. Contacted by AFP March 30th, Victoria Mittling at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's NRC Region 3 office said Yucca Mountain was raised at a special March 25th forum in Illinois, where the state's two U.S. Senators Richard Durbin and Mark Kirk met with NRC officials and state emergency officials to discuss post-Japan nuclear policy. There has been no decision on Yucca Mountain. Our NRC function will begin when a decision is made on this, Mittling added. But Durbin and Kirk are looking at Yucca Mountain with a degree of seriousness. I think in the end, Congress needs to win the battle to build the Yucca Mountain facility so that we can store nuclear waste 1,000 feet below the surface, Kirk said as quoted by ABC 7 News in Chicago. There are a lot of options out there, but I have supported Yucca in the past, and I am not walking away from that. I just think we need to consider the other options as well, said Durbin. Japan's disaster at power plant isn't over yet, by Victor Thorne. Near the coast of Japan's Fukushima nuclear reactor, tests reveal that radioactive iodine levels are 1,250 times higher than normal, while workers inside this stricken facility have been exposed to radiation that is 10,000 times the normal exposure. Despite a concerted media effort to downplay the seriousness of the crippled reactors that are plagued by highly radioactive water and exposed nuclear fuel rods, the Japanese government has urged residents within an 18-mile radius of the plant to leave the area. According to Japan Today on March 26th, those who have remained in a movement-restricted area 12.5 to 18.5 miles away from the plant say they are feeling increasingly isolated. Towns were abandoned by many people, apparently scared by the government's instruction to shelter indoors for fear of radiation exposure. Meanwhile, milk, vegetables, fruits, meat, and seafood originating from the affected area have been banned in Singapore due to radiation fears. Similarly, officials have declared Tokyo's drinking water unfit for children due to radioactive vapors that have been found in rainfall. In China, two Japanese tourists were hospitalized after being tested with severely high radiation levels. ABC News reported on March 25th, the General Administration of Quality Supervision, Inspection, and Quarantine said radiation levels that seriously exceeded limits were detected on the two when they arrived at the eastern city of Wuxi. To compound matters, Japanese officials finally realized that seawater being sprayed onto the exposed radioactive fuel rods might have actually been corrosive to the facility. They have since switched to fresh water delivered by U.S. naval ships. Page 15, The Dark Side with Victor Thorne. Israeli worm a threat to world's nuclear facilities by Victor Thorne. Did the Israeli-created Stuxnet computer worm contribute to Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant meltdown? Although a definite smoking gun does not exist, evidence, motive, and past acts of sabotage indicate possible Israeli involvement. During a March 23rd interview, Mark Glenn warned, "The real story is not whether Israel's Stuxnet virus caused the catastrophe in Japan, but instead the fact that they can use the computer virus anytime they want. If Israel can get people into Iran, are we to assume that they can't infiltrate Japan?" On March 21st, radio talk show host Mike Rivero theorized how this process works. The U.S. and Israel originally created the Stuxnet computer worm to destroy Iran's nuclear power station by targeting their German-made Siemens programmable computer systems. These Siemens control systems are standard gear for industrial centers worldwide, and it's been established by Symantec Corp that Stuxnet had corrupted 63 of Japan's personal computers since last October. The Daily Yomiuri reported on October 5, 2010, a Symantec engineer who has analyzed the virus said it was made using advanced technology, and it is highly likely a well-funded organization, not an individual, produced it. The Fukushima power plant utilized Siemens control systems with which Stuxnet viruses interfere and ultimately target. These automated systems were designed to shut down the reactors in times of crisis, but during the March 11th earthquake and tsunami, pumps, valves, and diesel generators failed to properly operate. By all accounts, Stuxnet enters into computer servers via USB memory sticks. Therefore, the only way plotters could have contaminated Japan's nuclear plant was if they had direct access. In this light, Ora Koren revealed a crucial piece to the puzzle in a March 18th Haaretz article stating that Magna BSP, a high-tech Israeli firm, installed security systems at Fukushima about a year ago. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the security system was designed to guard the plant against any hostile element seeking to seize radioactive material to use in a terrorist attack. In addition, Magna CEO Chaim Saboni confirmed, "We have an agreement in principle with the Japanese that we will provide protection for all of the country's nuclear reactors." The online news site HiBeam reported on December 9, 2000, Siemens has been awarded the contract to supply 100 fuel assemblies for Unit 5 of Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Station. In a March 3 article, only 8 days prior to Japan's nuclear disaster, investigative reporter Glenn Chapman wrote, "A German computer security expert said he believes the United States and Israel's Mossad unleashed the malicious Stuxnet worm on Iran's nuclear program." The expert he referred to, Ralph Langer, said, "The idea behind the Stuxnet computer worm is really quite simple. We don't want Iran to get the bomb." By targeting computer control systems manufactured by Siemens, Langer emphasized, "Digital safety systems are compromised and really bad things can happen. Your plant can blow up." So if it wasn't an accidental infection, why would Israel unleash this cyber weapon of mass destruction on Japan? It appears that lately Japanese officials have been especially outspoken in their denunciation of Israeli apartheid practices and genocide committed against the Palestinian people. In fact, on March 8th, only 3 days before the Fukushima disaster, Representative Naofumi Hashimoto called for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. He added, "The Japanese government is determined to continue its support for the Palestinian people." In March, these same Japanese officials condemned Israel's expansion into East Jerusalem and the West Bank while promising $1.1 billion to the Palestinian Authority. Proof of Israel's capacity and desire to disable nuclear facilities is legendary. On June 7, 1981, they attacked Iraq's Oserak reactor. Israelis also destroyed a Syrian nuclear plant believed to be under construction on September 6, 2007, after their radar systems were disabled by cyber attacks that involved a remotely controlled kill switch. Lastly, best evidence indicates that Iran's Bushehr operation near Natanz fell victim to a Stuxnet plague in 2010. The New York Times weighed in on this situation by quoting a former U.S. intelligence officer on September 26, 2010. This man claimed that the Stuxnet virus used to disable Bushehr originated from a top-secret Israeli intel squad known as Unit 8200. AFP's Ralph Forbes detailed this in a report in the January 24, 2011 edition. Following the Japanese meltdown, German leader Angela Merkel ordered the shutdown of her country's 7 oldest nuclear reactors. Furthermore, on February 1st, Yukiai Amano, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, proclaimed that Stuxnet posed a problem to every nuclear plant in the world. Page 17, Tough Talk from Jim Trafficant. It's Libya or Bust, literally, by Jim Trafficant. America is already involved in 2 official wars on foreign soil, Iraq and Afghanistan. Our coffers are bleeding dollars at a record pace. Washington big shots never meant an opportunity for war they didn't like. Now it's Libya. Don't believe the propaganda that America is not going after Muammar Gaddafi. He is the target. American intelligence operatives wanted desperately to tie the longtime Libyan leader to the terrorist attack on Pan Am Flight 103 Boeing 747 over Scotland, killing 270. The Justice Department ultimately indicted 2 Libyans for that horrific crime. The case was so weak that 1 Libyan was acquitted, with 1 to take the fall. The case was so suspect that the courts released the convict on an expedited schedule. America was never told the truth about Flight 103. I was the congressman who received the confidential intelligence report that contained the truth of that great crime. The CIA denied the report, claiming it was nonsense. The CIA said Trafficant hates his government. His report is nothing but falsehoods. Be advised that the CIA claimed the mining of the harbors in Nicaragua was nonsense, and that allegations of the CIA dropping leaflets over Nicaragua teaching people how to kill government leaders was nonsense. Also, don't forget the CIA claimed the downing of a U.S. U-2 spy plane flown by Gary Powers in 1960 in the USSR was nonsense. Our government knew who was responsible for Pan Am 103. Ahmed Jabril of Syria and Manzer al-Qasar of Lebanon were supposedly hired by Iran to strike an American target after we had shot down an Airbus from Iran, Iran Air Flight 655, killing 290 innocent Iranian civilians. Our government had to cover it up because Qasar was actually our own CIA operative working with our Beirut office to get our hostages released. Iran held 8 American hostages at the time. You may doubt this and ask why in God's name our government would cover this up. It's very simple. Qasar controlled all the heroin from the notorious Golden Triangle and shipped most of it to, you guessed it, the United States. The problem our government had was that the agents at the Beirut CIA office knew that Qasar was the biggest heroin pusher on the planet but turned their backs. That's right, with heroin as easy to find as aspirin in America. The CIA allowed Qasar to operate because he was a so-called valuable asset. Our government covered it up with money to the families of the victims and the indictment of the 2 Libyans. U.S. government officials will deny this with their last breath, but it's true, and they know I know it. Ask yourself this question. Why is heroin sold openly on street corners in every city in America? We do not produce heroin in any quantity domestically. Heroin is an import. Guys like Qasar have made billions from the veins of American addicts. Pan Am 103 was a classic example of state-sponsored terrorism. Jabril and Qasar were hired to put together a team to find an American target and destroy it. The 2 convicted Libyans may have been mules for Jabril and Qasar, but nothing more. Now U.S. officials feel they can go after Libya without the Pan Am 103 cloud hanging over us. How much more money can we throw around on foreign wars? If this was peacemaking, we'd be sending the Peace Corps. Who's kidding whom? America has fired 165 sea-launched Tomahawk cruise missiles, priced at $1.5 million each at Libya. America has sent B-2 stealth bombers on a round trip from Missouri for an approximate flying time of 25 hours per plane, at an average operating cost per hour of $10,000. These bombers are dropping 2,000-pound bombs on Libyan targets. Other warplanes are involved. America has 11 ships over there now patrolling the Mediterranean, with 3 submarines and 2 destroyers included. And consider the reports of 1 U.S. F-15E jet that crashed. The loss of this plane cost American taxpayers $80 million. According to published reports, both pilots were rescued, but I never was able to confirm what happened. We are bankrupt, literally, over these wars. In the end, we will attract more terrorism from enemies that have no missiles or ships. When will this insanity end? Get back at me. Page 18, The Ryan Report, from Vince Ryan. Communist Peace, Prosperity, and Stability Policy by Vince Ryan. Longtime Chinese dissident Liu Jianbin on March 25th was sentenced to 10 years in prison for inciting subversion of state power through essays he had written advocating democracy. As reported by the Epoch Times News Service, the judge in the Suning Court in Sichuan Province repeatedly interrupted Liu as he attempted to make a statement, his wife told various Western media outlets in China, but he managed to cry out, "I am not guilty." The Epoch Times is a free newspaper that offers a fresh look at our changing world. It monitors carefully the stifling of free speech in communist China. As of March 22nd, it was reported that 91,640,960 Chinese people have announced their intentions to quit the Chinese Communist Party and its affiliated organizations on a special website established by the Epoch Times. Regarding the Jianbin case, Gu Guoting, a Chinese civil rights lawyer who lives in Canada, told the Epoch Times, "Even according to the Chinese Communist Party standards, it's a judgment that entirely perverts the law. The language in Article 105 of the Chinese Penal Code, which deals with subversion of state power, implies the use of violence. But Liu Jianbin never did anything remotely violent," Guoting said. Meanwhile, China is talking about its view of progress and projecting its power, even while free speech and dissent is often crushed. Disturbingly, China Daily of the People's Republic of China ran a six-page promotional, read propaganda, supplement in the Washington Post of March 25th. The Post took no responsibility for the editorial content of the supplement. In his roadmap for the future, Chinese Premier Wen Jiabo promises improved livelihoods and a greater share in the fruits of the nation's growth. China's defense budget for 2011 is slated to increase by 12.7% to 601.1 billion yuan, $91.5 billion. This news evoked certain reasonable response from the international community. Whenever China increases its defense budget, some foreign observers use their imagination to misrepresent its national defense policy and strategic intentions, confusing international public opinion. The unfounded and deliberate misinformation is not worth responding to. But if some cases are not exposed, they could mislead the public, the Post insert added. The budget increase is timely and reasonable for modernizing Chinese forces and safeguarding the country's expanding national interests in the face of new challenges created by the changing international security environment. The overall international security environment may be stable, but tensions still prevail in some areas, especially in Northeast Asia, where there is a risk of military conflicts because escalating tensions cannot be ruled out. China needs to strengthen its military to defend its national security and maintain regional peace and stability, it continues. Finally, China's strong military will be devoted to peace, prosperity, and stability across the world, the report inserted in the Post adds. And speaking of propaganda, in the March-April 2011 issue of Foreign Affairs, a journal published by the Rockefeller-based Council on Foreign Relations, Wang Jiexi, dean of the School of International Studies at Peking University in Beijing, writes about China's search for a grand strategy, a rising great power finds its way. He makes some interesting observations, including that Beijing must strengthen its economic ties with great powers while minimizing the likelihood of a military and political confrontation with them, adding, "Beijing's preoccupation with GDP growth is slowly giving way to concerns about economic efficiency, product quality, environmental protection, the creation of a social safety net, and technological innovation." GZ continues that Chinese officials strongly wish to enhance what they call the cultural soft power of the nation and improve China's international image. The goal is to make China the most powerful nation in the world, a power to be reckoned with. But as is typical with the Post and its friends in the CFR crowd, power and internationalism are what matters, not the rights of citizens. U.S. ignores threat from China's financial terrorism, by Richard Walker. China and other adversaries may not have to worry much about U.S. military prowess if they can use cyber weapons to attack our highly complex digital infrastructure, including fragile financial networks. Those networks are so complex that Washington cannot seem to identify all the culprits responsible for the financial 2008 crisis or fully explain what went wrong. Although most people believe greed was at the heart of the collapse, there has been no comprehensive analysis of what caused it. Some experts believe we should look for explanations outside of Washington. China has been assembling a massive cyber capability, which could bring about the downfall of our major financial institutions in a time of war, heaven forbid. Did America's overseas enemies play a role in the 2008 crisis? While no rock-solid evidence has yet been found to support that position, it does not mean that there was no foreign cyber fingerprint on Wall Street's implosion. Unless there is an independent investigation, which is unlikely, we may never know the truth. Our enemies will surely know, however, that Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, and Washington will continue business as usual. In that event, a country like China may eventually be able to seriously cripple or take down a superpower like the United States without firing a shot. America is one of the most wired nations on Earth. Everything we need to survive, banking, power, travel, and communications, is routed through computers. While some of its power grids and a lot of the military installations have been hardened against cyber attacks, the greatest risk is the financial and banking sectors. The reality is our major financial institutions operate behind walls of secrecy that Washington has allowed them to build. They have created complex monetary mechanisms whereby billions, if not trillions of dollars, can be moved across the globe with a computer keystroke. A specialist who thinks we are presently at risk of cyber terrorism aimed at our financial well-being is Kevin D. Freeman. His 2009 study for the Pentagon, Economic Warfare, Risks and Responses, recently came to light. We are playing with fire by spending massive sums on weapon systems while ignoring the need to sort out the complexity of Wall Street's financial mechanisms, he contends. Congress was told in 2009 that China represented America's greatest cyber threat. Taking down a power grid on America's East Coast in the winter could kill thousands and cost billions. Attacking hundreds of supply companies that have little cyber protection could also hurt the overall U.S. economy, but a massive attack on the financial networks could be catastrophic. Yet little effort has been made to assess the true levels of vulnerability.